Hi, and welcome to the AA Grapevine. I'm your volunteer reader, Shelley Miller. Today, I will be reading from the January 2026 issue of the AA Grapevine. Some of the articles in this first section for the month we'll be reading are from a section called Stories for Day Counters. We kick off the year with our Stories for Day Counters issues, full of experiences by AA members about things that helped them most during their very earliest days in AA. Let's get started. And our first story is entitled Going Sane, submitted by Katie O. in Satellite Beach, Florida. This fun-loving newcomer thought AA meant the good times were over. Boy, did she get a big surprise. I have been nicknamed Trouble since I was 8 years old, but I never understood why. What looked like trouble to outsiders was simply my absolute insistence on having a good time. I just wanted to play, go on adventures, and connect with others. Fitting in was a top priority in my adolescence, and drinking became a part of that. Unfortunately, as my social lubricant began taking over my every thought and desire, it became a wedge in my relationships with others, my sense of self, and let's be honest, any trace of rational thinking. I once harbored resentment toward a friend for severing our friendship for no apparent reason, until a year later I learned that I had screamed obscenities at them during a blackout. Another time, a potential friend approached me during the first week of college, curious about smoking pot. I responded with, "It's great, you should try it sometime," and then I proceeded to smoke my joint alone. I wasn't about to share. My obsession with alcohol stunted the growth of any potential social skills, taking me to the edge of isolation, leaving me feeling alone and misunderstood. At a mere 20 years old, I found myself in AA. Entering felt like I was walking through the Milky Way, seeing glistening eyes and wide smiles at every glance. This biker chick chairperson opened the meeting, stating that we should silence any cell phones and beepers, adding, "And if you still have a beeper in 2020, please see me after the meeting." Later that week, at another AA meeting, an older man with long silver hair tied with a pink scrunchie remembered my name. When the people there told their stories, cussed, and talked about God, I knew that this cigarette, smoke-clouded room full of misfits like me was home. I know some believe that profanity is not a sign of spiritual growth, but to me it was part of my identification and relation process. I wanted what these people had, a spiritual awakening as a result of working the 12 steps, listed on the smoke-stained yellowed poster on the wall. Legend had it the poster had once been white many years ago. So I kept coming back. I got a sponsor and met weekly to work the steps. I started integrating with the old-timers, picking their brains, asking about the God of their understanding, and about prayer. They tolerated my youthful playfulness before and after the meeting, and taught me to settle down, pay attention, stay seated, and turn my phone off during the meeting. I had my first spiritual experience at 10 months sober when I thought I was going clinically insane. I called up a hospital asking for a brain scan. All this chaos in me, and I still didn't want to drink. I guess, as it turns out, I was just going sane. The AAs laughed with me when I told them what I had done. One meeting at a time, multiple times a day, I became an active member of the fellowship. They never kicked me out, even when I brought the stray dog I had found into the meetings with me, or when I made up fake service positions to post on the chalkboard, like the Debating Society and untrusted servants. I learned that I could be a kind, helpful person and still find opportunities to have fun and make a little trouble. The members of that group carried me through times of sorrow and times of celebration until we all knew I was ready to spread my wings and set out to accomplish other dreams. As I've grown up in AA, I've learned that the more I align myself with my higher power and my truest self, and the more I focused on being helpful to others, the more I am free to enjoy this life. At age 33 and with 13 years sober, I try to remain a beginner in AA. Why would I want to be near the end? I'm active in my current home group, I sponsor others, and I'm active in service outside and inside of AA. I have a host of friends, including that biker chick woman who chaired my first meeting. Today I find my higher power's love in connection with others. The God of my understanding has opened my world so much. I'm writing this story from a hammock in a small town in Nicaragua where I can see the real Milky Way. I trust that if I continue to allow God to discipline me, and the more I rely on the spirit of the universe, the more independent I actually become, to run, play, and live by only one rule. Number 62, don't take myself too damn seriously. And our next story is entitled Well-Made Bed, submitted by Gregory C. from Lawrenceville, New Jersey. A new member learns a few tricks to feel better and gain some self-esteem, and it's as easy as tucking in his sheets. When I hit my bottom, I didn't know what was going to happen next. I knew that I couldn't continue the way I was living, but I was scared to death of making a change. I finally realized that my life was so bad that whatever change I made might not make my situation any better, but it couldn't be any worse than how I was living. When I first went to AA, I realized right away at my first meeting that everybody in the room wanted to help everybody else. I felt relief. I remember saying to myself, "Thank God it's over." I met a man that day who told me in order for me to be successful, I would have to take an active role in my recovery. I told him that I would. I started going to meetings and felt good and safe at every one of them. At one of the first meetings, he told me after that was, "When you get up in the morning, make your bed." I didn't know why that was so important, so he explained. "When you make your bed in the morning, you're sending a positive signal to yourself," he said. "You're gaining some self-esteem that you haven't been feeling in quite a while." He added that no matter how bad my day turns out to be, I can come home and look at that bed and say, "Well, I did one thing right today." One of the next things he told me was, "Do what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it." If I did that, he said, I would start holding myself accountable for what I say, and I would think about what I say before I say it. He also told me, "Be where you say you're going to be, when you say you're going to be there." Then he added, "That means you make sure you arrive at places early so you're not rushing and trying to come up with excuses why it was not your fault that you were late." What these suggestions did for me was to start clearing my head of always having to make excuses for my behaviors. It made room for me to start committing to the things that I said I would do. In the Big Book story, Window of Opportunity, it says, "The primary differences between alcoholics and non-alcoholics is that non-alcoholics change their behavior to match their goals. Alcoholics change their goals to match their behavior." I owe a lot to that man who helped me. I hope these suggestions help others. If I'm passing on anything that's useful, it's because a kind man taught them to me. His name was David, and I will never forget him. And our next story is entitled 15 Minutes, and it was submitted by Kim P. of Redway, California. This newcomer was desperate to stop drinking, but days and hours were too much to handle. At the end of the meeting, they read the promises. "We think not," they all say in unison, like some kind of nutty liturgy. In fact, I knew these things were extravagant, the same way I knew so many other things. I knew I was wasting my time. I also knew the people chanting those words in this ugly, cramped room were a little goofy in the head. I also knew I wouldn't stop drinking. I'm not a cute drinker. I'm not a fun drunk. I might have started out like that long ago in a galaxy far, far away, but not anymore. I rode alcohol to the end of the line. My mornings involved me standing over the bathroom sink with a glass of tequila in my hand, salivating excessively until I forced the first swallow down, only to immediately vomit it back up. I would stand there drooling and sweating, repeating the process until I could keep one down. Then it was just a matter of staying in a blacked-out state of intermittent consciousness until my blood alcohol level would drop and my body, in self-defense, would attempt to reject it once again. I knew I was dying. I'd given up a job, a husband, all friendships, and everything else that made being alive tolerable. My children and family would be better off without me, right? I knew where AA was in my small town. I would drive past the little hall with its peeling signage on my way to the liquor store. I gave sidelong glances at the smokers loitering outside every evening. Sometimes I even parked across the street, watching in my rearview mirror as they hugged and laughed, happily chatting among themselves before stubbing out their smokes and moving inside like large children at the end of recess. After everyone went in, I would go to the liquor store and buy 2 or 3 fifths, telling myself that I would use these bottles to taper off. Instead, I would pass out with a lit cigarette and wake up to it burning through my bathrobe, scarring my neck. Once I woke up with a chipped front tooth and spent days running my tongue over the sharp edge, trying to find an equally sharp edge in my brain that could tell me how it happened. Those edges bothered me. The edges of conversations I could find evidence of, like the long minutes logged into my cell phone history. The demarcation lines of bruises, scrapes, and wounds. A map of injuries I couldn't recall. Groping the floor for a bottle, seeing it less than half full, waiting with fear to see if it was getting lighter or darker outside. This was how my story was ending, the same day lasting for weeks and months. I felt I didn't deserve a second chance. I did nothing to earn it. But then it happened, what I now believe was my first gift of grace. That day, I went into the store to get cigarettes and tequila, and a woman who's a member of AA walked in behind me. I knew her. She knew me. We engaged in the obligatory smiles and small talk. She asked what I was up to, and I told her I was just grabbing some cigarettes. I asked what she was doing, even though I knew she had to be on her way to the hall. She said, going to a meeting, then tilted her head in a funny way that I've since come to love. She smiled all the way to the deep end and then said, "You want to come?" And I said, "Yes." I said, "Yes." I didn't get a bottle. Instead, I followed that woman into that room full of people. I was so sick and they were all laughing too loud. I sat there and picked at the ugly contact paper covering the table in front of me. I think I even cried. I went home. Later at my house, my whole being started saying, "Get a bottle, I'm dying. You can stop tomorrow." But somehow I told myself that it still hurt this bad in 15 minutes, I'd go to the liquor store. I lived 15 minutes at a time until the next meeting. I don't know why, but that's what I did. I knew that I was going to die or stop drinking, and I didn't really care which one of those two things happened. But the next day at the meeting, they said, "Keep coming back." And I said, "Yes." 15 minutes, 15 minutes, 15 minutes. They said, "Read this book." And I said, "Yes." 15 minutes, 15 minutes, 15 minutes. They said, "Get a sponsor." I said, "Fine, but I don't need one." Soon those 15 minutes became days, months, years, and I've earned my place at this table. I know the words to the 9th step promises by heart now. We will be amazed before we are halfway through. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. My dictionary says extravagant means beyond any reasonable expectation. My life now really is beyond any reasonable expectation. It was a 15-minute gift of grace. The rooms, the steps, and saying the word, yes. And this next story is entitled, Finally Surrendered by Jackie H. in Bedford, Texas. When she put the bottle down, all the feelings came up. Stopping was tough, but she hung in there. I had a desire to get sober at my first meeting of AA. Yet at the same time, I had a desire to keep drinking. I was hoping that somehow I could continue to drink. Stuck between two worlds, I somehow raised my hand in the meeting and walked toward the person who handed me a 24-hour chip. I thought it was ridiculous holding this small chip given to me for not drinking for 24 hours because I thought I wasn't supposed to drink for the rest of my life. I didn't know how to grasp the concept of one day at a time. People in AA were talking about how to live sober. How to live comfortably without drinking. But I thought I was going to die from not drinking with all the feelings and emotions and reality sinking in. I just wanted to run. I was used to running away from myself. I wanted to get in the car and go to another city or another state and begin a new life. For many years, I did run. The people in meetings seemed relaxed, but I wanted to go home and never come back. My heart and mind raced, and the fear of some impending bad event would not subside. My body craved alcohol. Somebody gave me a big book, which I later threw in the wastebasket back at my apartment. Who was this Bill W. anyway? And why had he written this boring book that I didn't understand? Members at meetings were talking too much about their personal lives. I wondered how they could feel so comfortable talking about their lives like this. I was raised not to talk about my thoughts or feelings. My family avoided the elephant in the living room, which was my alcoholic uncle. I was not grateful at first that I found AA, even as it offered a solution to what was going on with me. I was told that I could get better, but a sober life looked sedated and boring, and I was used to chaos. I recoiled from discipline. After a few more relapses through the pain of my own self-will, I finally surrendered. I became willing to follow the suggestions I was given by a sponsor. Surrendering was a real gift for me. It gave me freedom to move forward and learn how to live sober and actually like it. After I surrendered, I was able to say my name and the word alcoholic out loud. My sponsor helped me to go through the steps as my craving for alcohol left. I was able to sit in a meeting and focus on what others shared. I began eating meals as I barely ate during my drinking. My fears began to subside. I became committed to the program. I learned its progress, not perfection. What a gift. I can relax now, knowing that one day at a time I can grow and enjoy life without having to constantly struggle anymore. And the next story is entitled Adding Up the Days, submitted by Sue G. of Highlands Ranch, Colorado. Afraid and confused, this newcomer didn't want what we have at first, but luckily she stuck with it. When I first walked into the rooms of AA, I came with a tough girl attitude. I didn't want anyone to get close to me. I was afraid if you really knew me, you wouldn't want me around. And I wasn't up for any more rejection. If you knew I was afraid, if you found out how vulnerable I truly was, you would use it against me and hurt me. My past had taken me to some ugly places. I had major trust issues. The meeting wasn't exactly what I thought it would be. The people appeared to be open and friendly, which made me suspicious. I hoped they didn't want anything from me because I had already lost it all. I had absolutely nothing left to give. I was broken physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, and as you might well throw in, financially. Hopeless is a good word for how I felt. I was a mess and trying to walk around like I was so tough and together. It was hard and frightening, but I had nowhere else to go. So I stayed and tried to listen and pay attention. They kept saying all these cliches, easy does it, surrender to win, one day at a time, and so many more that just didn't make any sense to me. I was confused, but I didn't want anyone to think I was stupid. So I would sneak around and ask people who I thought were safe questions like, what are they talking about? Eventually, someone would rearrange the wording a bit or use a different tone, and suddenly the light would go on. I would start to get it, and I'd get a spark of hope. There was one particular cliche that I didn't care much for, which was, if you want what we have, then keep coming back. Well, I looked around the rooms and thought, I don't want anything you all have. You're all a bunch of weirdos. I wouldn't even drink with you. That's how weird you all are. Then I took another glance around and thought, well, I might want that truck in the parking lot, or I'd like to have a ring like that lady, or I might just want to borrow her old man for a little while, wink. I think I heard that saying at every meeting. Ugh, my face didn't have a filter and I'd roll my eyes. But the people in AA somehow could read me. I figured out later it was because they all had been where I was then. After the meeting ended, this older lady came marching over to me and said very softly with such kindness in her eyes, Sue, you may not want what we have, but go home tonight and think about it. Do you want what you have? Do you want people to keep treating you the way they've been treating you? And if you don't, then keep coming back. Wow, that was a powerful message for me. This time I heard it, and it made sense. I didn't know enough to know what I wanted or even needed, but I did know I didn't want to keep on living my life as it was. I decided to give AA a chance. That gave me a tiny spark of hope that kept me coming back one more day. But I though tomorrow I don't hear something at the stupid meeting to help me stay sober, then to hell with it. I'm going to go drink. Luckily, I kept hearing something that made me stay, and the days, weeks, months, and years have added up. I just love the way my HP sends his messengers. Forever grateful. And this story is entitled, It Was the Laughter, submitted by Marianne M. in Drexel Hill, Pennsylvania. I never expected to hear so much laughter when I walked into AA. To me, the sound of people laughing felt like fingernails scratching a blackboard. I wasn't looking for camaraderie or fun. I just wanted the pain to go away. On Friday evenings, I liked to go to a candlelight meeting so I could slip in and not have to make small talk or look anyone in the eye. In early recovery, I was excruciatingly uncomfortable in my own skin. Nothing felt right, let alone good. One night, the speaker was an older gentleman who radiated a kind of warmth that was palpable, even from my seat in the way back of the room. I listened with rapt attention as he told his struggle with alcohol had brought him to a ledge where the pain was so great he just wanted to jump and end it all. How he hated himself for not having the courage to jump. How in his darkest moment he cried out for help to a God he didn't believe in. I don't remember the rest of the story, but I remember the way he told it, with such a sweeping sense of peace and ease it dispelled some of my own pain. My ledge was constructed of fear and shame, and sometimes it taunted me. If he could be a jumping-off point and recover, maybe I could too. I gravitated to him after the meeting and said somewhat desperately, "I want what you've got." He smiled at me with kind eyes and said, "You've already got it." "What do you mean?" I asked. He tapped his heart. "Right here," he said. "It's inside you. It's inside all of us. We just have to get out of the way." Then he gave me a hug. When he was hugging me, he called someone over my shoulder. "Well, look what the cat dragged in. If it isn't Ponytail Steve," he said with a laugh. He released my hug and greeted this guy in a leather jacket who wore his white hair pulled back into a ponytail. "Watch what this guy says. He's full of beans," said Ponytail as he winked to me. The two old friends laughed and it sounded easy on my ears. I walked out of that meeting that night into the fresh, crisp October air. People went milling about outside in groups of one and threes. One guy in an old-fashioned newsboy cap played a little harmonica while another pantomimed a silly jig. Everyone started cracking up. And as I walked away, I recognized something inside I thought I'd never feel again. A hint of laughter. This story is called Family Can Wait, and it was submitted by Elizabeth J. in Columbus, Ohio. A dry, unhappy newcomer faces spending the holidays with a family in a cabin far away. What could possibly go wrong? In December of 2019, my life was spinning out of control. I had been wrung out dry for about 3 years, but I hadn't worked a single step and only dabbled in going to AA meetings for the past 6 months. Mostly I went to meetings because my girlfriend, now wife, said I was a nicer person after those meetings. So yes, I went to get the proverbial monkey off my back. I wasn't drinking, but I sure was miserable. While my family of origin started planning the holiday festivities, I was also facing my second major surgery since May of that year. If I were to spend time with this part of my family, I knew I would have to drive to meet them just days before my surgery, while in fairly intense physical pain. For some unknown reason that I still can't discern, my family decided that we would meet about halfway from each of our homes in a cabin in the middle of nowhere. My family was the opposite of woodsy. We'd never gone to state parks or other kinds of places to hike, and I'd only camped out with friends in high school. While I don't think it was even an intentional choice, my family, when I was a child, only went where you could legally have alcohol, like public lakes and public beaches, and of course, restaurants and homes. So here I was. I had a decision to make. Would I go to a cabin in the woods 2 days before a major surgery with no plans other than to sit around, play cards while staring at liquor? Or would I tell my family I couldn't make it this year, knowing it would likely upset them? It was one of my first acts of surrender. I went to what I now call the AA Beginners Meeting. I'd never spoken at a meeting before, but I got the courage and posed my question to the group anyway. All I can say about what happened next was that a power greater than me told this man at the AA meeting to break all the AA rituals at once because he could see right through my question. "I know this is crosstalk and I'm sorry," the man said, "but I think you need to hear this. If I hadn't worked a single step, didn't have a sponsor, and decided to go to that cabin in the woods for that holiday, I'd be lying to myself if I didn't say it was for the sole purpose of losing the little recovery I'd racked up thus far." As he spoke, he looked me square in the eyes. I felt seen. I knew he was right. The holidays are hard, and families can make holidays even harder. I had a choice: endanger the precarious recovery I'd found so far, or set a boundary. I made a decision. For the first time, I chose sobriety. I chose sanity. I chose a different path. In the few years later now, I would love to say that my decision to skip the cabin was well received, and that I've reconnected with my family. Unfortunately, I cannot claim that truth. What I can gratefully attest to is that I got busy in service, worked the steps with a sponsor, and sought outside help to manage my outside issues. Some lovely material things have happened as a result. I now have a stable income, and my wife and I are buying our first home. However, a lot of hard work and the willingness to take suggestions, I've maintained sobriety, stability, and oftentimes sanity. Do I miss my family immensely? Yes, I do. However, making the choice to set a boundary rather than folding into the comfortable holiday guilt and shame quite possibly was one of the most important gifts I've ever given myself. I couldn't have done it on my own. However, the man across the room who was willing to offend me with his honest appraisal of my situation, that man might have saved my sobriety and quite possibly my life. And that's all the time we have for today's AA Grapevine. You've been listening to the January 2026 issue of the AA Grapevine. This has been part one. Thank you for listening. My name is Shelley Miller, and I've been your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.